Coming up on Boston Public Radio, it's a different kind of Friday for us. Emily Rooney starts things off. We'll get her take on the Sochi Olympics, Tsarnaev's lawyers seeking some judicial relief, and the Herald and Globe columnist assault on Deval Patrick. Then we'll continue our Alex Bean conversation of yesterday with you. Could you grow attached, I mean really attached, to a robot? Then Callie Crossley on new TSA concerns, Michael Sam trying out, and Necco making a comeback.
Governor Deval Patrick joins us to take your questions and ours on his new initiative to lower recidivism rates in the prison system, the troubles at the Department of Children and Families, and his star turn with our sister station, WCRB. All that coming up on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. And you're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Hi there, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
So here with us in Studio 3, as she is every Friday for Open Mic, is Emily Rooney. And no, you did not fall through some kind of space-time continuum.
Really, it feels weird.
It's weird for us, too. The governor will be with us in the second hour today, which is why Emily is here with us at noon. Emily, nice to see you.
Good to see you guys. I know, so, I'm not used to being the lead story.
I know. Well, you are the lead story. You are
don't screw it up, Emily.
Pressure's on. So Jim and I, who have been rather obsessed with House of Cards, unfortunately,
to the exclusion of all else,
have missed most of the Olympics.
Oh.
But give us the highlights. Give us the
highlights. I watch it all.
You do?
I do. I go home at night, turn it on. Even if I know who won, I enjoy watching it.
I like watching it, too, but you're not...
I don't really care who wins. I mean, I did watch that whole skating thing last night.
Yes.
And there's a big petition going on now.
Which skating, please?
The women's skating.
Ladies, as they're called.
So the 17-year-old from Russia won, but everybody's saying, including Katerina Witt, who won the thing twice, and got the gold, that the South Korean girl should have gotten it. So there's a big petition going on. You know, judging the judges, and I love all that stuff.
Now, is it background, or you other than that one, which
I am,
is fairly interesting?
I am athletic.
I know you
are. Athletically inclined. So I like sports, and I love winter sports.
Well,
so.
The thing that I love about it is they are just obviously incredible athletes.
Yeah,
I mean, you look at what they're able to do. Oh, I love the 15-year-old Russian that was able to do the spin with her head, with her foot, rather, totally over her head.
Yeah.
It was a from the foot at the bottom, the foot at the top, it was a straight line.
Yeah, I know.
90-degree angle. What was it?
180-degree angle.
Yeah. It was unbelievable.
I know.
But you're not troubled.
I know that stuff.
The Russian kid who won, the 17, right? I knew nothing about her. She won her national championship at age 12.
Yeah.
So that means if she was the best in Russia at age 12, that she's probably doing this from the time she was 2.
Yeah.
Does that kind of thing bother you? I mean, I don't like this. Send
you
off
so
the kid
out of it. You are so
to Siberia
to
train.
That's what the Chinese do. Well,
that's what the Americans do in tennis, your favorite sport.
Yeah. What do you think the Americans do in every other sport? Yeah. Kids start playing soccer night to play soccer like almost year round if you want to play soccer in college.
It's a ticket to something better in a lot of these countries. So,
It's a ticket to college tuition break in the United States of America, which is why so many kids want to do it. Now, I have to ask you about Bodie Miller, the oldest Olympian to win so many.
At 36.
At 36, I know. But I think he was the oldest. He's the oldest guy who have won a medal at that age, correct?
Yeah.
But there was a controversy, of course, when he was quizzed by a reporter.
That is a loose term. That she is not a reporter.
What is she?
So that's the other thing. She's a skier.
Okay.
And they hired her because she knows a lot about skiing. And somebody was probably in her ear saying, ask him this, ask him that, ask him this. So she starts asking about his brother who died last year. Some
29
kind of
years
seizure
old.
How weird is that?
I don't know. Weird. But, you know, and she went for the third question and he got upset and, you know, got emotional about it. But he was fine with it.
He tweeted that he was fine with it and defended this woman.
I didn't think it was that big a deal. What was a bigger deal was that NBC chose to put the whole thing on the air knowing that it was on tape. So it was like they were maximizing it. I mean, I guess I would have used it, too.
I was just going to say, you used to be a big-time news director.
Exactly.
I didn't think it was outrageous myself. I thought it was the guy got upset.
Yeah.
She was asking about his brother who died in this just horrible situation so short a time ago. I thought it was fine.
It was a little
So do you dream of marching in the closing ceremony?
Yeah,
tell the truth.
Do.
Don't you hold the flag?
What kind of medal would I like to have? Let's see. Snowboarding.
Why is there no tennis in the Olympics?
There is.
Summer. There is.
I did not know that.
Yes. Serena won it one year.
And the Brit won.
But there shouldn't be because that all these professional athletes play tennis. That's not right. It's like basketball and baseball. These are not Olympians.
And hockey.
That's ridiculous.
Well, except the argument goes that for years, I mean, like the Miracle on Ice, probably the most famous Olympic moment for Americans maybe ever. It was because it was American amateurs performing against Russian professionals. Yeah. Well, the notion is a lot of these other countries using professionals. So, by the way, I like the amateur thing too, but it just does not happen. The genie is out of the proverbial bottle.
Well, most of these professionals are amateurs, so to speak, but you know, they're just coming through the ranks. But these people like Serena, I mean, it just seems ridiculous.
God, I didn't even know there was tennis.
Yeah,
so
Emily, it hasn't been around that long, but yes.
Actually, on our news a couple of seconds ago, there was mention made of the fact that lawyers for the younger Tsarnaev, the living Tsarnaev, have asked the judge, this Judge O'Toole, to lift special restrictions that they say are inhibiting the ability of his attorneys to competently and adequately communicate with him, and the judge basically said, try to work it out, and if not, come back to me. What's your
it's
take
outrageous.
On this? Which is outrageous.
The FBI is spying on these lawyers as they interview their client, and they're scanning documents that they're showing that they're going over with Tsarnaev. So they're basically recording everything that's going on between them. It doesn't seem right.
Well, this is a continuing theme of government power out of control, unhinged, taking advantage of people's civil liberties.
The guy is going to be convicted. What are we doing here?
Well, whether is or not, we should be clear. The communications you're talking about are purely between his lawyers and him.
He should be able to do those things in private. I'm not sympathetic to Zohar Tsarnaev. I have no sympathy with it, except for when it comes to the next issue we're going to discuss. But I think he should be able to have communications with his attorneys in private without the government, without us spying on him. You know, the way this works is, Jim, you know more about it than I do, but you have to show the other side evidence. You can't hold stuff back. So the fact that they're doing this now, they're going to have to share stuff anyway. Well, what are they doing? Why are they spying on him?
Well, you know, where is he being held?
I think he's at Devon.
I think he is at Devon.
In what kind of prison?
What kind of confinement?
I believe it's a federal
prison. Yeah. I mean, the Federal Bureau of Prisons clearly is running amok all over the country, and nobody's doing anything about it. Nobody's looking into
it. Well, let's be clear. Let's not Judge O'Toole, about whom I know virtually nothing, has the power to grant all these motions that basically say you are inhibiting his ability. And by the way,
it's clear that you have to have judicial intervention in these situations. I mean, Sal DeMacy's in a federal prison, and we can't get any answers
Can
I just get back for one second of this O'Toole thing? The other reason it seems to me
Attorney
that
General.
The judge should go out of his way in this case to be fair is not even for the sake of fairness, but because it increases the likelihood of a successful appeal after he's convicted.
Exactly.
Now, obviously, they're going to appeal a conviction anyway, but it's going to go faster and more smoothly if there aren't clear
issues.
Exactly. You know, speaking of that, you alerted us to something that neither of us had seen, which was a piece in the New York Times by a guy who I believe is the executive director of the Board of Correction or something in Colorado. Tell this story.
Yeah,
it is amazing.
Everybody will probably remember this story about a year and a half ago. The guy who had his job before, I think he's the commissioner of corrections.
Clements or something was his name? Yeah.
The other guy.
Yeah.
For the state of Colorado. Anyway, a guy who had been held in administrative segregation, which is in a cell with nothing, no books, no stimulation, nothing. You're just there and, you know, you're getting your food through a little slot. Anyway, when he got out of prison, he killed a pizza delivery guy so he could get the outfit, put on the outfit, knocked on the door of the commissioner and blew him away. And a lot of the feeling was he was so upset about having been held in administrative segregation. So this new commissioner asked to be put in solitary confinement for a day. And it's really a riveting tale, isn't it? How you lose all track of time.
Yeah.
You know, the lights are on. You don't know what time it is. He actually broke down and asked the guards what time it was. He said 20 hours, and he felt like he was going crazy.
Well, can I tell you something? The amazing thing, the reason I could relate to this to some degree, I may have told you both or one of you a story. When I was a young public defender, there was a program. We spent the night in jail.
Really?
No, we spent the night in jail. But let me tell you something. The amazing part of this is, like this guy, and it was nowhere near solitary confinement.
I thought you were going to tell me you'd been in solitary confinement.
Even though you know, as this guy knew, that there was a finite end to this, unlike somebody who's there for a month or 100 months or 20 years, That's not soothing at all.
No.
You sort of a smile on your face. You're saying, on Wednesday, you know, I can deal with this. You don't have a watch. When you read what this was like, I don't know if I was scared, even though I scare pretty easy.
Yeah.
I was intimidated by the whole thing. By the way, the guards were not told, even though I think it was fairly obvious, the guards were not told that we were not real prisoners, so that we were treated at least relatively much like prisoners were.
Here's why the public should care about this. As this commissioner writes in this piece, these people are going to get out of jail, the vast majority of them. And they're making the prisoners more violent in prison by these kinds of treatments. And the story says, which I found impossible to believe, but he runs the place, so he should know, that prisoners are released almost directly from their time in solitary confinement back into the let out of jail.
Which is unbelievable
to me. So they talk about the psychological effects of this solitary confinement, the nightmares, the heart palpitations, the paranoia, the aggressive fantasies, and impulse control problems. So it's not too much of a stretch to say that this guy that got out of jail and killed the previous commissioner was driven by his confinement.
We're not soft on crime. I'm not soft on criminals. I believe in punishing people for doing horrible things. But this borders on cruel and unusual.
But it goes beyond. It's not the cruel and unusual I care about and Marjorie cares about, but it really is the point that Marjorie made, is even if you don't care about cruel and unusual, even if you don't care about fairness to a prisoner, what you should care about is yourself and what the prisoner comes out like. And by the way, it's one of the things we're going to discuss with Deval Patrick. It's one of the deals he was addressing yesterday.
He has expressed his concern about it, I think.
I know he has. He specifically addressed his concern yesterday.
Well, I always say to people that are concerned about the prisons being soft, they should go visit a few. And I think whether you're going to the House of Correction in Suffolk County here, whether you're going to Walpole, which we no longer call
Walpole.
Yeah, I mean, okay, that is a scary, scary place. And frankly, the Suffolk House of Corrections is no day at the beach either. I mean, these places are, there's the clanging of the doors, the closing of those.
The noise, the smell.
The smell, the staleness of the whole place and who's in there. This is no day at the beach. Mm-hmm.
But again, if people are listening to this and shaking their heads saying, oh, please, you know, she says you're not soft on crime, you're not bleeding hearts. To me, almost everybody gets out of prison. Sarnaev is not getting out of prison, but the vast majority of people do get out of prison. You want them better, as you said, Marjorie, than they were when they went in.
Rehabilitation is supposed to be part of the deal, isn't it? And obviously, in these particular situations, rehabilitation went out the window.
I don't want to steal my own thunder, but I'm listening to an interview that we're going to air in a couple of weeks with Michelle Kosolek. He said something interesting.
Michelle Kosolek is the person who killed his wife, who is seeking a sex change operation.
Anyway, this is something I was listening to, and he says, you go to prison as punishment, not for punishment. So in other words, some people, you know, the guards and other people think it's their job to make you miserable, to hurt you, but prison is the punishment, not something beyond that, like solitary confinement.
You know, Emily, you are often parts of conversation that Marjorie and I have away from you.
Okay.
Both of us independently, this is a true story, independently we read by chance a story about how the gluten-free movement in America is exploding.
Yeah.
We both come in and we say to each other, as if it were scripted, we say, what do you think Emily's position is on gluten-free food? So we figured we'd ask
you. Well, I've been on a tear about this for years. I'm not new to this gluten-free thing because very, very few people have celiac disease.
Very few, yeah.
6%, supposedly.
If that. So this has become a diet trick for women largely. And I know a ton of them that are on it. But now, the other day...
I'm sorry. 6% are sensitive to gluten, only 1.8% according to this story.
Yeah, I was going to say, celiac disease is very rare.
Celiac disease, 1.8%,
I'm sorry. And my list is about Florida, just to tease you there. But I was in Florida the other day. And I said, oh, I'll make the rice. I ran into this store and I bought a bag of what I thought was basmati rice. I get back and it's gluten-free, this free, that free. And I cooked it. It was tasteless. It was horrible. Gluten-free rice. Give me a break.
You know, it's really delicious. The gluten-free cakes and cupcakes.
Awesome.
And,
have you seen the bread?
I've tried it once by mistake. It's horrible.
And we're not making fun of it. I mean, people with celiac disease, it's a serious thing.
We have to apologize for everything we're talking about
apparently.
Today.
No, because I went on a tear about this years ago, and on the radio I was going off about gluten-free. And now I get this email, my daughter suffers from... Yeah, she's the minority, the vast majority.
But why do you
people.
Care? The part
because
of
it's because it's interfering with what we eat. Because somebody comes to my house for dinner and says, I'm gluten free. Oh, geez.
So then you know. They won't eat?
Yeah, good.
But the
and you have to ask now in advance.
I know. You have to serve several different dinners.
You know what's interesting? Did you see in this article in the New York Times, the single largest purveyor, if that's a proper word, of gluten-free foods in the United States, you see what entity it is? Wegmans. Which is, Seller. Wegmans, which is now about to be on Route 9, I guess, in April.
Well, that's because it's all those people who live in Newton and Brookline that are on the gluten-free diets.
Well, maybe that is what it is.
Well, lots of people think that they lose weight from those.
They do. I see people lose weight.
So what's wrong? So?
That's fine.
But it's
just
not,
don't tell me that that weed is bad for you and this it's a diet tool. I'm fine with that. But it's not because wheat is somehow.
You know, no one is forcing you to eat gluten-free foods. You're aware of that. Hey, before we get to your list, Deval Patrick is coming at 1 o'clock, which is why you were moved up. A couple of days ago, Howie Carr, this one's not surprising, writes piece, worst governor in the state's history. Joan Vinocki, who will be with us Monday from the Globe, clearly a liberal-leaning columnist, trashes the governor's performance yesterday. Scott Lehi, sort of a centrist, does the same thing together. And the Mr. Magoo reference,
was
a bit too. What's your reaction? There's almost like this, and we're going to talk to him about it, this nonstop assault on the op-ed pages.
It's what I call a piling on. One person does it, then the next person, the next person. Are the problems really that bad? Are they really the governor's fault? Is the connector the governor's fault? Is the DCF the governor's fault? I don't believe so.
Well, there are some managerial issues.
Also the Globe, that thing with the guy who died in Bridgewater State.
Yes.
These things happen.
Joshua Messer.
I'll tell you something. The Globe is not happy until they can put on the front page that the governor is doing something because of their report. That they were the ones who called that to our attention. And first they were ragging on him for not, calling for some kind of an investigation into that. Finally, he calls for the investigation just to get them off his back, I think, and they put it on the front page.
But in all fairness to the Globe in this situation, and then we'll get to, while you're here, your list. This 2009, when this kid was killed, a young man was killed at Bridgewater State, the medical examiner ruled that it was a homicide.
Yeah.
And until this Globe thing by Mike Resendez came out a week ago, I guess Sunday or whatever it was, it's been X number of years. No one's been prosecuted.
Sure, the governor
nothing has been
about
happening.
It.
We'll find out. I guess we'll
talk. What I thought was extremely distressing about that story was that they talked about how these guards at Bridgewater State Hospital, which mainly deals with people with mental illness, that the guards there had no training in restraining people with mental illness.
That is unbelievable.
Almost everybody there has mental illness, don't they?
Yeah,
so
something like that.
I guess it's a sense of no confidence that you're in desperate straits. Your kid has schizophrenia, which is horrible, and you kind of expect that these supposed experts are going to have some idea what they're doing. And it's the same thing with DCF. My God, if people take away your children, you hope that they're not going to go to places worse when they take them out of your house. And that's kind of the issue, I think.
Okay, we're ready. Here it is.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
Early rendition of Emily's list.
Well,
Take it away, Emily.
I gave it a little tease. So my list is about Florida. And
good.
True confessions, I was in Palm Beach. So it is,
beautiful.
The world of wretched excess.
Were you doing some reporting there?
Yeah, I was doing reporting.
Yeah.
All right, so number one, all anyone talks about, anywhere you go, it doesn't matter what's going on in the world, is golf and tennis. That's all anyone talks about. I mean, anywhere, you're walking down the street, the second thing everybody talks about is they complain about people who only talk about golf and tennis. And it's them. It's like, really, the same people say, anyone talks about it is golf and tennis, but they're the ones doing it.
Now, wait a minute. Are they talking about their own golf and tennis games?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Or ragging on somebody else's.
Their tee shot from the 16th?
Yeah. All the detail.
All the detail.
The minutiae.
Yeah.
I play line one. So-and-so doesn't want to be in line two. I just got a call from so-and-so. She's upset. She's playing line six. I mean, that's what they talk about.
So did you expose them or you just sat there silently?
All right. So this is really unbelievable. People put their dogs in their golf carts to take them to the dog walking park. I saw it 50 times. The dog in the – and where are they going? To the dog walking park. But they're in the golf cart to get to them. It's true.
I would do that if I had a dog.
That's crazy.
All right. So not just a few people. Everybody has a new car. And it's a 2014. When I say a new car, I mean a new car. A woman pulls up to a traffic light. I'm with this friend of mine. She says, did Alan get you that Maserati for Valentine's Day? And this is red Maserati, and woman says, as a matter of fact, he did.
Well, that's really sweet.
I know,
that's
but it's
beautiful.
Like everybody, everybody. In fact, I started counting. I think half the population owns, you know what a Bentley GT speed convertible is?
I have no
idea. It's a $240,000 car. Everybody has one. If they aren't, except for the woman with the red Maserati.
But all the extras are included for $240,000,
so
aren't they?
Is this the Wall Street set taking their winter break, I assume?
I think these are people who live there.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. How do they get so much money?
That's what we want to know.
Yeah,
they're hedge fund managers, I guess.
I guess so, yeah.
All right. People think it's too cold to go swimming when it's 80 degrees. Somebody actually said that to me. It was 80, and I wanted to go swimming. She said, it's only 80. I said, no, it's 80. It's hot. It's great. It's good. No, can't swim until it's 90. It's true.
I accept it. I'm just listening. I'm taking
it all
in.
Everybody has a boat.
Yeah.
No one uses it.
They don't use it?
The boats are everywhere. You know, they're just all up and down.
What do you mean? It's just to own a boat?
I think it's just to own it. Okay, they're all up on those things. And only a handful of people actually register their boats. I guess we knew this in Florida. You know,
for tax purposes?
Yeah, for tax purposes. So the boat that I was visiting on was parked right next, I mean, like 4 feet from Tiger Woods' boat. His boat, the Privacy, is...
is that what it's called, the Privacy?
Privacy. Okay. Is registered in the Cayman Islands. It just doesn't seem right.
What does his boat look like?
It's a...
motorboat, powerboat.
No, it's a yacht. It's a 135, 40, 50-foot yacht, you know, with a crew of 12. And that was going to be my next thing on the list. Tiger's crew isn't allowed to talk.
What do you mean? If you say something to them, they're not allowed to speak?
They're not allowed to speak.
It's like the beefeaters over there.
Yeah. So you say hi, and they can't,
it's true.
They can't say hi back?
No, they can't. I'm sure it's because they don't want to engage in anybody.
Yeah.
They don't want to, well, where's is Tiger coming today? Or, you know, say,
okay, a little bit more on the boat, please. Is it like wooden on the inside, teal?
Well,
on the
you can't
inside?
Get inside. I mean, it's got a wooden deck. It's
wooden
got a,
deck,
it's got a sun deck.
I
saw Elin there a few years ago. She's obviously out of the picture, but
right.
I don't know how often Tiger uses it. But it's got a crew of 12, so it tells you how big it is.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, let's keep in mind, for whatever this is worth, the only reason Emily knows this
exactly.
is because she was on the boat four feet from
Privacy.
Boat?
Which was only a few feet smaller.
Really? Oh, you have fancy friends.
And she got to the boat in that red Maserati.
I did. All right.
Maybe
okay, so Social Security insecurity is not going to be anybody's problem in Florida.
Well,
if you follow me.
We follow you.
They're all going to be. So, all right, this is true confessions. I paid $19 for one martini. I know.
Wow.
I couldn't
How was
even,
it?
It was good.
It was really good.
I didn't go back for another.
Really?
That seems a little... What are they usually, like 14?
I don't
12?
Know. Aren't they like $8 or something?
Oh,
right
no.
Here?
They're more than that.
Is
Marjorie's
it,
a big
is it
martini
$19
drinker.
At
she
the,
would know.
At the Four Seasons?
I've not been to the Four Seasons lately, but I know like if at a usual restaurant, they're like 11 or
so
12.
So wait, did
I
you
think.
Enjoy it less because you had to pay
$19? No, I didn't know until afterwards.
Oh, you didn't know.
Yeah,
okay.
I was waiting
did
for
you have a little
fun.
Ice coating on the top? That's the real...
That is
you know, I don't really drink martinis. Somebody... got me one a few weeks ago, and I thought it was delicious. So this was like my second martini.
Oh, my God,
life.
They're great.
They are good. I mean,
but, you know, you'll keel over quickly.
All right, so this is also going to come as no surprise. I was the one without the facelift.
I bet everybody there has facelifts.
These
some
people
of them
are never
good.
Inviting you
yeah.
back.
Some of them
let
are good,
tell you.
But a lot of them are bad.
You know the great line? Who was the great line that talked about how the woman had when she was sitting down at the table, she looked like she was about 50, and then she stood up and you realized she was like 85 because she had the facelift, but she was
one
really
one woman in particular needed to get her money back.
Really?
Yeah, she was really.
You
she
had to be
back.
Very careful.
Yeah. Or finally,
you know, we're huge in Palm Beach. I just want you to know in terms of your friends.
Well, finally, I just want to say I realize why people go there. I mean, the weather is just spectacular. It's divine. It's just unreal.
Did you see
it's another world. 3 hours from here, and you're in a tropical, you know, because of the jet stream and all that. You were just in another world.
Yeah. Did you see the dating scene on the octogenarians at the bars? I went down there and saw it to Naples.
Cougars. And yes.
Yeah, cougars, but they were often like these very elderly
some
women.
Some look like hookers.
They do look like hookers. And the elderly women in hot pants. That was
I did.
Shocking.
I had a drink at what is that? I think it's called
whatever.
Taboo. Whatever. It's one of the hot bars. Yeah, anyway,
sure.
Right before I left, and there's a couple of them in there.
Okay, I want to find out after the show whose boat you were on that was right next door to Tiger Woods. That's all I can say. Maybe next year
it
you invite me and Jim. You know, we could be the crew, Jim.
If you want a little advice, I'd be doing that list on Beat the Press tonight. But you're probably not. So what are you doing?
Oh, let's see. We're doing a couple. We're doing the Bodie Miller episode, whether that was as big a deal as everybody seemed to be making of it. There's also this interesting story about PBS. We're sort of doing a story on ourselves, which is PBS was bicycling around this series called Pension Peril. But it turns out it was funded by the Arnold Foundation. John Arnold is the number one critic of municipal pension plans.
Pension liabilities, huh?
So it wasn't properly disclosed. And meanwhile, NET ended up giving the money back and then canceling the series. And, you know, the sad thing is that they're probably right about municipal pensions. But, you know, going to the source of the criticism to fund the thing that was largely critical was a huge mistake.
One of Marjorie's favorite topics, I should say.
That's right.
Emily, it's been a pleasure.
All right,
that
bye.
Was one of your finer
In
lists, by the way. That was the top 10. Emily Rooney tonight, Beat the Press at 7 o'clock.
And Emily joins us every Friday for Open Mic. Usually she joins us closer to the 1 o'clock hour, but not today because Deval Patrick is coming then. When we come back, we're going to ask you if you can see yourself becoming attached to a robot. Or maybe you already have. Have you named your Roomba? Do you consider Siri your soul sister? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
You know how we close the numbers with the yield on the 10-year T-note? Did you ever wonder about that?
He's a T-bill, just a treasury bill.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Next time on Marketplace, we're going to tell you why it's from APM.
Tonight at 6, here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Roadside Attractions, presenting In Secret, the new thriller starring Elizabeth Olsen, Oscar Isaac, and Jessica Lange, based on the classic novel Thérèse Raquin by Émile Zola. In Secret, now playing.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We've talked a lot with you about animal rights, animal cruelty, focusing on how some people can express more compassion for animals than for their fellow humans. But what about robot rights? There's now a society for the prevention of cruelty to robots. And if people are being cruel to robots, it means they're having relationships with them, obviously. We talked about this yesterday with Globe columnist Alex Beam. We now want to have the conversation with you at 877-301-8970. As preposterous as it seems, seriously, do you have an attachment with one of your machines? What about, for example, your Roomba, you know, it's the cleaning thing, or your car, or a smartphone? And if any of you have seen the movie Her, which Marjorie has, where a man falls in love with his computer's operating system, it's not as far-fetched as it seems. 877-301-8970. You know, Alex in his column, Alex Beam in his column we discussed yesterday, said some things that didn't surprise me. For example, some people in the military develop these incredible attachments to these robots that help disarm and disassemble the improvised explosive devices, the IEDs. That's not so surprising
to me.
Did
you read, though, where if something happens to the robot and it can't be brought back to life, with quotes, unquotes, or fixed, some of these guys have given them burials with 21-gun salutes.
Well, but think about it for a second. When you're in the most dangerous, tense of situations, and this is essentially your partner, even though it happens to be a machine, I have to say that doesn't really surprise me at all.
Should they really give the robot Purple Hearts?
Well, no, but, and by the way, in one case, they did.
They
here,
did.
Right?
I know.
Well, you know what also doesn't surprise me? There's stories we read this morning, which I had not read when Alex was here, about people in nursing homes stroke victims, who have are helped with exercise and those sort of things by machines. It's not, especially since you saw Her, it's not surprising at all. What gets surprising is Alex writes also about these Pleos. And they are these $150 robotic dinosaurs. And he talked about this experiment that someone described to him where essentially people got one of the Pleos. And correct me if I'm wrong here, Marjorie, from his column. And they played with it for a little while.
Yep.
And then he said, okay, go destroy it. or right. destroy your friend's plea, whatever.
Whack it with a hammer.
And they want to do because they felt like there was an attachment. There's this great, let me just play this
did you
for you.
See, hold on. Did you yeah. see that? We saw the websites of these little toys.
Yes.
I mean,
we're
they
play
are really
a sound
adorable.
From one.
They come out of their little eggs and they march around and they sing to you and they can dance. And when they get cold, they start shaking like your dog would outside. When they hot, they pant like a dog. They like you to pet them. They have a certain way they want to be petted. They want you to be held. I mean, I can certainly see where, I mean, let's hope that there aren't that many adults playing with these things, but you certainly could see kids. You know, you wouldn't have to get a dog.
It isn't
get
about
one
kids.
Of these...
You can imagine the kids doing it. It's adults. Listen, this guy is Keith Shaw. I didn't never heard of him before. He's a columnist, cool tools columnist for something called Network World. And he demonstrates sort of what Marjorie's talking about, how much Pleo, the robot dinosaur, does not like having his tail pulled. Listen to this.
Pleo will let you know if you do something that it doesn't like. For example, if you hold it by its tail, which is, you know, one of the things in the reviewer's guide, it will start to screech. Now, to show you what I mean, I'm going to demonstrate this, but I'm only going to do this briefly for the purposes of this video. So if you have any small children watching this video, have them turn away, or if you're a little squeamish, you don't want to see this happen, all right? So here we go. This is just for the purposes of this video.
That was nauseating. But let me give you another example. If you watch any of these videos, if you pet the dinosaur,
they
the robotic it. Dinosaur, it does what a dog or a cat does.
Yeah,
it twists
it
its
preens.
Head in a direction so that, you know, you can get at the area that it most wants.
The little dinosaur like to be pet underneath its chin, apparently.
In any case, as preposterous as this seemed when I was
one.
Reading Alex's column, except for the military thing, which I totally understood about, you know, in these most intense pressure-packed kinds of environments,
Jim.
It appears there is a far broader connection
people
between humans and their robots.
Are lonely.
No, it is what it. No, you know what it is. It's an
lonely.
Extension of this thing we talked about with animals. Is what do these things do? They don't talk back.
That's right.
They are companions. They are forgiving of everything.
Right.
They are. It's unconditional
there is,
relationship.
Of course, one little fly in the ointment.
What's that?
Well, that your dogs do have feelings, and we are. Putting all our feelings into something that actually can't feel. So there is a little problem there.
I'm not arguing for this. I'm explaining what appears to be a reality that I was totally unaware of until yesterday.
I have very warm feelings for these Rambas. I don't have one myself.
Well, because you want something to clean your house.
I was at a dinner party. No, I was at a dinner party, and a friend of mine who just got a Ramba took it out, and the whole party of eight, we were like transfixed. We wanted to hold it. We wanted to cuddle it. We wanted to speak to it. And you know what, Jim?
You took it home.
No.
Don't tell us after that.
It spoke back.
Okay, 877-301-897. Do you have any relationship with a robotic device? And if you don't, can you close your eyes unless you're driving for a second and say to yourself, can you imagine the kinds of things that we're describing? And by the way, not one of them was fantasy. This is all things that have happened and relationships that are real. 877-301-8970. We're talking about robotic relationships with human beings. We're not talking about robotic relationships between human beings. That's a topic for another day. Carl from New Hampshire, you are first on Boston Public Radio. Is this our Carl? Hello,
it
Carl.
Is.
Carl.
Oh,
is
my
it?
Goodness.
Carl is a very
our
fine
buddy.
Friend of ours. How
yes.
are you, Carl?
Oh, you know, this is kind of a tearful reunion. I'm getting a little choked up.
We're thrilled to have you.
Hi.
You know what happened? I've been on hold for 2 years at that other number, and they just barely came on and told me. You know, every time I think I finally found the perfect relationship,
yeah,
somebody comes along and ruins it. I mean, the whole point of having a relationship with a robot is that you can be abusive.
Jeez.
I've got a robot vacuum. I've got a robot dog. I also have a relationship with my weed whacker, though it's not really a robot.
Oh, my God. Now, we know, Carl, what's that?
So now these people come along. That you said that it's prevention for cruelty to robots?
Yes. Yeah.
All right, so I have to go back to the dating websites. They've ruined yet another relationship.
But, Carl, I mean, can't you see this could put Match.com out of business? That's a lot less hassle, you know? You don't have to go meet somebody at Starbucks and, you know, spend your go through 5 or 6 dates. You can just
need a can of oil.
Exactly.
Well, you know, in deference to these people and the sincerity of their cause, I'm willing to give a little, and I've decided to put the leg humping dial back to 7 from 10.
Goodbye, Carl. It's a pleasure.
Bye, Jim. Bye,
it's been
Marjorie.
Far too long.
Wonderful to talk
Carl
to you,
Carl. Was a regular caller
I'm
to
sorry.
Our former radio lives.
He was on hold for 2 years.
Well, he found us. That's
it's
all
unfair.
Matters.
They should have told him that we'd gone.
877-301-8970.
Listen to this.
What's that?
These robots can follow your eyes, follow you with their eyes. So I'm looking at you right now, right? I mean, if I were a robot and you moved six feet to the left, I could follow you as you moved. We respond to things that follow us with their eyes.
No, there are enough qualities that are human-like.
I mean, think about that. Think about in your life how many people, you know, especially if you've been married a long time, you know, the days are probably long past where you're staring into your spouse's eyes, you know, with longing in your eyes. But that's what you can do with your dog, right? The dog stares at you. You stare at the dog. And you can stare at these robots.
That's fabulous.
I can see the appeal completely.
Yeah, it's huge. Let's go to Peter in Providence. You are next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about robot-human relationships. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Love your show, but come on. This sounds like the movie Ted.
Oh, I forgot about Ted.
Oh, that's right. Ted.
Now, for those who haven't seen it, you should give a little bit. I have to say, I laughed so hard I almost exploded.
Yeah, he was in love with his
teddy bear.
Describe
the movie a little bit.
The movie Ted, the teddy bear comes alive and is a lifelong buddy.
I mean,
people can barely get along with people. Now we get along with robots. Please. I mean, I understand the military guy who uses robots.
I totally get that. Yes, so do
I. You know, but the rest of it, why don't we try getting along with people? And then if we can accomplish that, then we'll start on robots.
Well, you know, Peter, you're preaching to the choir, at least with me. I think that is part of the problem that many deny exists, but I know exists, and is this whole deal with some part of the population caring more about their pets than they do about other human beings. And this is just a natural extension of that problem. Peter, thanks for the call. By the way, Ted, for those who don't know, is this movie, and I'm embarrassed that I love it. It is one of the funniest
movies.
It is.
I watched it too.
It's with Wahlberg and this little teddy bear. And what's the name of the guy who wrote it, who hosted the Oscars a couple of years ago? I think, what's his name?
I don't remember.
Well, I'll tell you in a second. He's a fabulous comedian. And the thing is, like, wildly funny. And
well,
it's about a relationship. A little boy
gets
a teddy bear, and essentially his whole life, this teddy bear, which talks and moves and whatever,
and he has to decide,
is his best friend.
Between the love of his life or the teddy bear, and it's we don't want to ruin it for you, but
let's not.
Some can guess the decision that he made in that regard. Sheila just emailed in, she says, she has a love-hate relationship, intense, with her bathroom scale.
It's a different kind. Dee, you're in JP. We're talking about robots and humans. Hi, Dee.
Hi again.
Hey.
I think this is kind of fascinating because it really brings to light how we are somewhat robots ourselves. We are programmed to react to all sorts of things that we think we have control of, but we don't. I'm sure the dinosaur robot, looks cute somewhat.
They're adorable.
Oh, totally cute.
Adorable. Yeah.
And that's part of it. It's reacting to the eyes, the noses, smiles. It's all pretty much, we're kind of programmed to be attached to something that is moving and makes sounds and reacts. So I think I just kind of want to throw that out there.
Well, I think that's exactly what the designers have in mind. I think you're spot on. I've never been near a Pleo, but Marjorie and I both saw them on video this morning, and that is exactly how you feel. Thanks so much for the call.
The social robots, which is what one of these stories focuses in on, talking about dealing with people who are lonely, they're shut-ins, they're patients in hospitals, they're people suffering from dementia, they're in nursing homes, autistic children, they've had great success there too. And people apparently kiss them and hug them and confide in them and give them gifts on their birthdays and Christmas and so forth, and they get very upset when the robots have to leave.
You saw her. I did not.
I did.
Did you find the story totally implausible?
Well, at the beginning, I thought this is ridiculous.
I knew. This is ridiculous. How'd you feel at the end?
You go on vacation to some isolated cabin in the middle of the Rockies somewhere, the snow and ice, with your computer in your ear. But by the end of the thing, you totally saw how this could happen. This person, it wasn't a person, it was a computer. But, you know, at the end of the day, he'd come home and he'd tell her about his day and she'd tell him about her day and they'd converse and they'd have dinner together. I mean, it was great. They even had sex together. I'm not going to tell you how they did it. But it was...
They did?
Yeah, okay. They did. And guess whose voice it was, Jim?
I know who it was.
Whose
Scarlett
voice?
Johansson.
That's right.
I know.
Whispering in your ear, Jim.
Okay, fine. Let's go to Boston. We're in Boston. Linda, you are next on Boston Public Radio. Hi there, Linda.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thanks for making it. Hi.
Hi. Do you guys remember way back the Twilight Zone in the 60s, Rod Serling?
Oh, Rod Serling was a genius. And by the way, I have seen Twilight Zone episodes as recently as 2 or 3 months ago. They're I mean, dated, but fabulous television. Go ahead,
yeah,
Linda.
They're still on the air. And yeah. He had written an episode about a man who had been in some space mission, and he was stranded on a planet by himself, and he creates this female robot. She doesn't look like a robot. She looks like a woman to be his companion, and then the rescue ship comes, and there's only room for one space on the rescue ship, and he has to decide whether he's going to stay with her just because he's so crazy about her or go back on the rescue ship and go back alone without her back to America.
Do we ever find out what the decision is, or is Serling just leave you there hanging?
I can't remember the end.
By the way, that almost gives me chills. I mean, if you have no familiarity with The Twilight Zone, that was a groundbreaking form of television. It really was in the early days. It is great. And when you watch it, I think is it in black and white, Linda? I think it's in black and white. It is really dated stuff, but it is just great.
I bet he stayed on the planet with his robotic lover.
Hey, Linda, you told the story beautifully. Thanks so much. One more quick one, and then we've got to move on. Jess, you're in Lynn. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Jess.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great, thanks.
I guess I just want to say I don't think it's that far-fetched that something like this could happen, especially I'm mostly speaking about people my age. You know, I'm a millennial, technically, and we grew up with, like, the first generation of Tamagotchis and Pokemon.
Great
and, like,
point.
Creatures we had to take care of and raise, and when they died, it was horrible.
Exactly.
So I guess, you know, it makes sense, I'd say.
You know, why is that anymore?
Chia pets. You can get attached to them, Jim.
While you're calling as a millennial, and obviously those things are far more advanced, how about something that was inanimate? Well, I guess those are inanimate, too, but, you know, like a teddy bear for a kid. Now at 40 years old or 45 years old, there are a lot of adults that have kept the teddy bear that they grew up with.
Have you?
Yeah, it's true.
Well, there, Jess agrees with me.
I have my dolls and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. I'm glad you jumped in there so I didn't have to answer Marjorie's question.
Do you have your blankie, Jim?
Jess, go to what?
You have your blankie?
Just go watch Ted. It's funny. It's foul, and it's real. It's foul movie, and the language and the imagery is horrible, but it is really funny.
No, I can see. I totally understand why people get attached to these things. It makes perfect sense to me. Okay, up next, we're going to talk with Callie Crossey to go over the week's news. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
A look at the science behind obesity and the possibility that we've gotten the causes very wrong. I'm Kara Miller. That's this week on Innovation Hub, Saturday morning at 10, here on WGBH Radio.
Come celebrate the rhythms of Ireland at a St. Patrick's Day Celtic Sojourn with Brian O'Donovan. Tickets are on sale now. For more information, visit wgbh.org/Celtic.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Lesley University, where creativity empowers educators, artists, and counselors to turn their passions into their futures. Lesley University, what will you make happen? More information available at lesleyuniversity.edu. And Dover Rug and Home, rugs, carpeting, hard surfaces, and window treatments for today's lifestyle and many budgets. You can visit Dover Rug's new showroom in Natick featuring a squash club or doverrug.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Here with us in Studio 3 is the host of Sunday Nights Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. Hello there, Callie.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Marjorie.
Well, you're going to touch on one of my favorite subjects today, the TSA, but there's been this new concern about we weren't supposed to take off our shoes. Now we're supposed to take off our shoes again. What's going on with that, please?
Well, we just got the threat level elevated about shoes, and they are referring to chatter that's been out there, a lot of chatter about bombs being placed in shoes and in cosmetics. So we had just got the story that the TSA was setting up these sites, including here in Boston, three sites, where you could get a pre-check. You could pay $85, go online, fill out your stuff. If they approved you, you go to one of these sites in Bourne or Dorchester or Waltham and, you know, go through some testing to make sure you're not the terrorist. And then after that, when you got to the airport, you just zip right through the line. Well, one of the things you wouldn't have to do anymore is not wear your shoes. And, you know, I read that story and I got a little queasy about it, even before the terrorist threat came out, because of the story I'd read about the guy who wrote this thing about how the TSA is really all over the place. He's a former TSA agent. He wrote a huge piece for Politico.
Great story.
And that just freaked me out. So the idea that now, you know, certain people will get their, don't have to take their shoes off, does not make me comfortable. And I like convenience.
Well, there's a great headline on this TSA worker story called Dear America, I Saw You Naked. And this kind of confirms everything Jim Browdy always said about these naked scanners. Yeah. And one of the things he talks about is how you'd love to get the TSA room to be in the person viewing the naked scanners, because you go in there with your TSA girlfriend or boyfriend and have a little cuddle and make fun of the bodies. And, you know, and there was soundproof, so they didn't know what you were doing in there. So that's one of the big things that he said. They were looking at everybody. And
that they were for show, as I said to you from day one.
Did not work.
Yes. That's all.
Oh, that you could put a gun on the side or some other very nasty weapon on the side of your body and get through the but what else did you like about this piece?
Well, I also liked that he pointed out that, you know, they would pull you aside if you were rude, and they just wanted to, and that they were profiling people from various countries and no doubt other folks as well. But basically the thread that ran through his piece that just makes me nervous now that we're back to talking about shoe bombs is that there's just not enough careful attention going through those lines right now, even without, let's take the rapid scanners off the table, which now have been confirmed to not be working. But, you know, they're not paying close enough attention. And that scares me, people. I guess.
Well, you know, there's a reporter who's one of the investigative reporters for ABC News, and I forget his name every time I mention this on the air, and I shouldn't. Brian Ross.
Yes.
Who once a year, or maybe once every 2 years, tries to smuggle bazookas, whatever it is, through the TSA, and for whatever reason, ineptitude, inadequate staffing, I don't know who is to blame, the outcomes are just staggering. Mm-hmm. I mean, the amount of stuff he is able to get through without even trying to hide it. Now, the flip side is, the problem is people like me who are so sick of the excessive and intrusive searching and things. So on one hand, people are saying they're not like me. Yeah. They're not doing their job well enough and not being careful enough. And then out of the other side of my mouth, I'm saying, but I don't want to stand in line for 45 minutes.
You know, I
don't want to see everybody with their shoes off. So in defense of the TSA, and I'm not going to do much of a defense, in defense of them, we are schizophrenic in terms of how we want them to behave.
I would be okay if I knew that the pre-check program, that was a rigorous going over of who you are.
Right. It's a brilliant idea if it works. You know, I agree with that. You know.
Well, the Israelis, we talked about this once before, about how rigorous the Israelis are. They have really trained people in their interrogating people face-to-face about where they're going and what they're doing. But I bet they're profiling all the time over in Israel.
It's also much more expensive per person because it's not machines. They're humans having to do the job.
And they're hiring people, you know, for more than, I don't know how much they pay. I don't think it's
not much, I'm sure. But one of the ironies here of this list of countries that they are looking at people from is they leave off the list Saudi Arabia, which is where the bulk of the terrorists in 9/11 came from. So this is a political decision, obviously.
Yeah.
They're going to be profiling all these Middle Easterners and people from Cuba, and they're not going to profile the people from Saudi Arabia or Pakistan. I mean, it's just bizarre. So once again, it's like a total government ineptitude, and we're all inconvenienced by something that probably is not going to make that much of a difference.
And, you know, and people who stand in those lines, they always say, you know, I've said it myself, okay, but I'd rather stand in line and make sure you're being careful about whatever. So it's not that we object to standing in line per se. I mean, nobody likes to. But if you know that at the end of the line you've been thoroughly checked, I mean, the last time I went to London and had to go through their thing, I thought, oh, great, I'm done now, because it felt like they had, you know, stripped off everything. And then you get down the hallway and you're like, what is this? It's another check, because they are not kidding around. And I was just like, wow, this is really intense.
This was Americans or the British?
I was in London and I was going through, just a checkpoint. And I thought I had, you know, one checkpoint, I'm done. And they had done as rigorous a check at that point. I mean, I couldn't imagine more. It was like times 10, the TSA. So I'm lollygagging going down the hall to my gate. I get down the gate. Here we go again. They had enough. I thought, whoa, they're not playing. And you know what? You got to either get serious about it at some point in the process. And so if we're at the point where we're talking about people can, you know, certain people, if they pay $85 for 5 years, by the way. So this is once you get through the pre-check, you're OK for 5 years. You don't have to take your shoes off. And trust me, I hate this. I don't want to take my shoes off, but I just don't feel comfortable that they're at the point where we can let people do
I have one word to say about all this.
What?
Amtrak. That's it. I know you can't take it to London, but the solution to the mess
and here's my problem.
Is Midtown to Midtown.
I know. I'll fly across the street, Jim. I mean, I just got to confess.
Okay, let's move to another thing. Tomorrow, well, Michael Sam was the biggest story in America maybe, I don't know, 10 days, 2 weeks ago. It sort of subsided a bit. But then tomorrow, the combines, and what that means in English for those who are not NFL fans, a couple of hundred of the top draft choices, not the biggest ones often don't show up, but above, other than the top handful, all of the really good players show up. They measure them. They question them. They see how fast they can run. They talk all of the places, the general managers of teams they might draft an individual, ask them all kinds of questions, some of which are grotesque and incredibly intrusive, and the conventional wisdom is that Johnny Football, the kid from Texas, and that Michael, because he is such an electric personality, a great player, and won the Heisman last year, best player, and Michael Sam are going to be the focus of all the attention. This is a pretty important moment, not just for football, but arguably for America, no?
I would agree, and you got to remember that last year the attention was on Manti Te'o, remember, with the Invisible Girlfriend.
The Invisible Girlfriend. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's going to be a lot. I had never heard of a combine. You know, I'm not a big sports. I was like, what's a combine? But, you know, they're literally, because I think of combine, I think of a tractor going through crops, and I think to myself, well, this is really a harvesting of a different kind, because you really got to show your physical prowess, and then you got to be interviewed, you know, probably the way the TSA should be interviewing you. This is the way that these guys are going to be interviewed. So it is a moment. Part of what may give some people an out, Jim, and I'm not the sports person, so you correct me.
Yeah, I'm an expert.
Michael Sam
yes.
changed positions.
Yes, he did.
So some
because he's
saying,
not big enough, they say, right. to do what he does. He did in college in the pros, so he may have to do another position, which gives an out to a lot of teams to let him drop to lower rounds.
Right.
But you don't think you don't think that, I mean, some people have said, who I do not think have any anti-gay agenda, say, you know, it's possible if he doesn't run fast enough in the 40-yard drill or something, it's possible he won't even get drafted.
Yeah.
Now, I don't accept the notion. And in a fair world, if he doesn't have the qualifications, he shouldn't be drafted. Yeah. However, I am totally convinced that the guy who runs the league, I mentioned his name is Goodell. He's jokingly called Fidel Goodell because he rules with such an iron hand. Don't you think he's told these teams? I'm telling you right now, this guy has got to be drafted because I am not going to deal for months with the notion about the homophobic NFL. That's my take on this. And maybe he'll do well enough that he gets drafted in the third or fourth round.
Well, since that's what it brought me back to when I read that he was changing positions from, you know, defensive, where he was apparently quite good, to rushing lineback. And he's right on the edge, I guess, the cusp, that, you know, there's a little wiggle room there. I mean, and to some degree, it was the same thing that happened with Jason Collins, though people tell me Jason Collins was not the athlete. That's the NBA player.
No, he wasn't. He wasn't.
That Michael Sam is. Michael Sam has won these national awards. Yeah. He's been recognized, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, you still have that little wiggle room, so I don't know. And remember, what was the guy that got excoriated for putting the anonymous quotes out right after Michael Sam came out, and he just sort of did a survey of folks and said, okay, tell me what you really think.
Yeah.
And they said...
Sports Illustrated guy who interviewed the general managers and those people. Yeah.
And they said, oh, no, we wouldn't have him here. Nice guy, you know, good pick, but not here. So I don't know. That was unvarnished because they spoke anonymously.
Okay, let's move to something that is near and dear to my heart,
Netco,
which I think is part of your under the radar.
Yay! Netco, the candy company in Revere. Are there some news from Netco, please? What is the news?
Biggest smile on Callie's face. I think it was since last June. Why is that, Callie?
I love those wafers, and I love the licorice
no
ones.
No one loves them as much as I do.
Oh, no, I bet you I love them more.
Can I tell you, before you tell the latest story, they had a plant on Main Street in Cambridge, which closed, 10 years ago or something? If you go to Bertucci's or someplace across the street, or Coochie Coochie is there, you can still smell the sugar and the flavors from the neck away. It is literally, it's a decade later. It is unbelievable. Go ahead. I'm
so
sorry. What's
delicious.
Happening?
They were hanging on by a thread. And, you know, that it, not only is it a local attraction, I think, because and such a wonderful local business to be here, but we would have lost all those jobs. But they brought in this new CEO, Al Gulachetsky. And for the last 3 years, he's sort of just been rebuilding, you know, tightening up some union stuff, you know, working with the unions, you know, got the restructuring inside. Look back at the recipes. They changed the recipe for the candy hearts at one point. Remember, these are the people that make also the candy hearts. And
hate
people,
them.
People,
horrible.
Oh, I love them. But horrible. People went crazy. And so they put that back and, you know, got the wafers out there more. And now they're even expanding to a Clark bar. They own Clark bar. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
So he'll
potentially
holiday.
Hundreds of new employees is
yes,
the bottom
yeah,
line
you
here
know,
in Revere, right?
And, yes. And then also keeping the ones that could have lost all their jobs. And then, you know, 3 years is seems like a short time, but when you're trying to get a business back on its feet in the modern world to appeal to all of us who have many options, I mean, I think that's saying something.
You know what the workers yeah. should demand there in Revere when they expand? Part
what?
Of their contracts, the union should demand that they get free bus shuttle to the casino. So you can go right, you get paid on Friday.
So what is Necco? They make Necco wafers and
the little candy hearts.
The candy hearts
yes.
and the
now
wafers.
Now they're doing the Clark bar. That
Clark
bar. So it's a peanut butter chocolate bar.
Okay.
All right. And so Hill Holliday is working with them to do this national big, huge campaign for the Clark bar. And that's going to be part of their extension. Because, you know, I suppose people might think, oh, Necco, they only do the candy hearts. That's a limited
time. Yeah, I didn't
time.
Know they did anything else.
Yeah, no. They also are offering a 24-karat solid gold large size candy heart that says, I heart you. For $20,000.
He hasn't sold it yet. Can we get back to the wafers for a second?
Yes.
Part of the problem with the wafers, and I love them, and yeah. apparently you do too.
Yes.
They look, the wrap, everything looks like it's from another era. Mm. And so I think one of the reasons people don't even try them is because they seem old school. I am not a big candy eater. However, well, you're frowning. You do not like Necco
wafers, You don't like
Necco
wafers?
I do not like Necco
oh,
wafers.
My God. Give them to
no,
me.
Really.
Oh, my
we
God.
I used to play communion when I was a kid with my cousins. They look
How
like
can you eat just one? I just, I'm just like,
I'm not
oh.
into Necco wafers. No, I'm into chocolate.
Oh, hey, well, chocolate, well, then the Clark bar chocolate. May be your thing.
Well, except speaking
and your
of chocolate.
Peanut butter, too.
I love
So this is your thing.
Reese peanut butter
peanut
cups.
Butter out of the jar.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
fantastic.
We do. With
hey,
a spoon,
before you go, speaking
delicious.
Of chocolate, another yes. story that I know you're on top of that is great, and then the governor's here, so we got to go, is tell the story, which tell the story about the Girl Scout cookie salesperson at a particular location. I love this story.
I think that Danielle Lee should get the Small Entrepreneur of the Year award. She's a Girl Scout in San Francisco. She, with her mother's permission, set up her table outside the Green Cross Medical Marijuana Dispensary.
This is great. This is so great.
She sold out in 45 minutes and had to call for backup.
How great is this?
I love this. And she said they're awfully hungry when they come out.
Oh, God.
That really is.
Is this the greatest story?
Yes.
So we're going to see that
story.
All over Massachusetts,
well,
obviously.
I mean, you know, with your parents' permission, and her mother said that was fine, and, you know, and the, by the way, the Green Cross people are thrilled, and they're giving half some of the proceeds of stuff that they purchased to Alzheimer's. So they said it's...
Hey, we're talking
I know.
Girl Scout cookies, Necco wafers, Clark bars. We're talking a whole new burst. We're not supposed to be eating all these things, I guess, but...
Well,
you know,
you're the moderation queen, Marjorie. Your
I am
view
the moderation.
Is eat everything in moderation.
These are local businesses, and
I
got to hold up the Girl Scouts because I was one, and I was a
I didn't
very,
know that.
Top,
were you really?
Oh, yes. And I was a top cookie seller.
Oh, excuse
How
me.
How far did you get in the Girl Scouts?
I went to, you know, just two girls. I didn't go all the way up to the top level.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the sixth grade, you know, I sold out my entire community.
So you flew up from Brownies.
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yes,
and I was,
know.
As you know, a star Cub Scout. In my, okay, well, I wasn't. Callie, what are you doing Sunday night?
Well, Necco is one of my, is my under the radar piece. We're also taking a look at some of the issues that bike riders have, which I never think about, when the streets and the sidewalks don't get plowed.
Yeah.
You know, and these are people who are really need this as a way of transportation. And also, got to say, back to Revere, the poor Boy Scouts just got kicked out of their meeting space that they've been meeting in for 10
yeah,
years. The
I
Catholic
know.
Church. We don't know why. Nobody's saying anything.
Probably because the Boy Scouts now allow gay scouts. Isn't
well,
that's
your speculation. They've not said, but the Boy Scouts are looking for a space.
We'll be listening, Callie. They could okay. do the old Necco factory. Actually, no, that's a bio company. Callie, good to see you. We'll be listening
right.
Sunday
I
night.
Hope not to have to fight you for wafers in the future, Jim.
See you soon.
All right.
You can catch Callie Crossley Under the Radar Sunday nights from 6 to 7. Callie, as always, thank you for being here. Up next, Governor Deval Patrick joins us. He'll be taking your questions and ours. Stay tuned for Ask the Governor.
That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
The inner baseball of songwriting.
In some ways, I think the songs are complete out there. And, you know, the better your catcher's mitt, the better songs you catch.
Roseanne Cash's new album caught a lot of great songs about her Southern roots, her musical life, and her very musical marriage. The Threads and Rivers of Roseanne Cash, next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Boston Ballet, presenting Close to Chuck, a trio of contemporary dance with a tribute to artist Chuck Close and composer Philip Glass, featuring works from Killian, Ello, and Martinez. Now through March 3rd at the Boston Opera House, bostonballet.org. And Subaru of New England, offering the new Subaru XV Crosstrek Hybrid with symmetrical all-wheel drive. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. More information available online at subaruofnewengland.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Joining us, as he does once a month, every month, to take our questions and yours, is Governor Deval Patrick. Governor Patrick, good to see you.
What's happening, Jim?
Exactly. Now, if you have questions.
Marjorie, how are you?
Wow, you sound cheerful.
Well, if you have questions
for
the governor, here's the phone number. It's 877-301-8970. You can email him at bpr@wgbh.org. And you can also see the live stream, which means you can watch the governor and, as the governor will tell you, the back of my head, if you choose, at WGBHnews.org. Good to see you, Governor.
Nice to see you both.
Nice to see you, too. I've misplaced some of my papers. I'm disorganized here. But you made this big announcement yesterday about the problem of recidivism, people going back to jail too quickly after they come out of jail. You've announced some new initiatives. Please tell people about that and why we need them.
So there is a... We focus a lot on the sensational cases, of course, because they are newsworthy.
We do?
Because they're newsworthy cases. But in fact, the number of people who go to prison for the rest of their lives is a small proportion of the total. 97% come out one day. And many, many of them, for a whole host of reasons that go back 20 and 30 years, come out more dangerous than they were when they went in. Because we have devastated the programs and processes to get them ready to be successfully reintegrated. So we're talking about and have been working on for a number of years now ways in which we can better prepare people for their release so that we, through that, keep the public safer. A couple things. We're reclassifying prisoners who are eligible from a higher security to a lower security. The lower security, the more eligible you are for programming. We're reinstituting training and education programs for medium and minimum security prisoners in our prisons. For the lowest security, we're stepping them down to a number of the sheriffs who are working with us. And that's really good because then prisoners can be closer to constructive family members. They can be closer to community organizations that will support them when they're out. They can begin to build those relationships. Again, all about helping to assure that people, when they get out, get on the right path, stay on the right path, and make us all safer.
You know,
how does this come to fruition? I mean, you've proposed these initiatives. What has to happen?
So the reclassification, we've already started. In fact, there are 125 prisoners who've been classified into lower security clearance using, you know, an objective measure and who are either in or heading into programming right now. We have agreements with, I think it's five of the sheriffs so far, and a couple of others have expressed some interest, and they're taking the lowest, the most minimum security prisoners into their facilities. They have space for them now, and they have programming available. You know, the sheriff out in Hampden County, Mike Ash, is famous for this. They have the lowest recidivism rate of any sheriff in, I think it may be in the country. It's certainly in the United States. And he has for, I want to say, 30 years been working very successfully with a number of community partners as well as law enforcement on successful reentry. And we're trying to scale up the kind of thing he's been doing elsewhere in the Commonwealth.
Our number is 8. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I was just going to mention the two other things. You want to say the number first?
No, sure.
877-301-8970.
Thank you,
that
Governor.
That was not me, but thank you. If you want to call the governor, go ahead.
I was just going to say that two other parts of this that I think are key. One is moving away from treating drug addiction as a crime and more as a health issue. And we have some while here in Massachusetts had treatment facilities that, frankly, are just overwhelmed. And when they are overwhelmed, our law, and we're the only one in the United States who does this, requires that civilly committed addict go to a prison. And that's not the best setting. So we are proposing through the budget, and this is to your question, Marjorie, about who has to do what. There are some things we will need legislative help on, and one is some budgetary help in expanding the number of treatment beds.
What's the number again? I forgot. What is it? I'm sorry.
The number is 877-301-8970.
It's
right over the back of your head.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, I don't want to turn around. Now, Governor, on a related note, the Attorney General recently in a speech confronted a pretty tough issue head on, saying that states should reconsider their laws that don't allow felons to vote. And I have to say, some of the statistics, staggering. 5.8 million Americans, who obviously when they're released, he's talking about 5.8 million Americans can't vote. 2.2 million of them are African American. Mm. In Florida, Kentucky, and Virginia, according to Eric Colbert, that means that one in five blacks who are age eligible to vote cannot vote. How sympathetic are you to Colbert's call?
I'm very. I mean, he's talking about something that Massachusetts has confronted and dealt with some while ago, which is not the ability of felons to vote while they are in prison, but once they have paid their debt to society, regaining that right to vote, and that seems to me only fair.
What's the state of affairs in Massachusetts?
My understanding is that once released, felons regain their right to vote here in Massachusetts.
Our number is 877-301-8970. One last thing I want to broach before we get to the calls. The mm-hmm. vote on a casino, the Mohegan Sun proposal in Revere, is Tuesday. And obviously, if it's successful, then it'll be between Revere, Everett, and possibly nobody. I mean, they don't have to give an Eastern Massachusetts license, but it's likely it's Everett or Revere if they prevail. This is all against the backdrop of a ballot question that the Supreme Judicial Court could decide to place before the voters in November.
You mean the one to repeal?
Repeal the whole
thing.
Expanded
gaming? Mm-hmm.
The leading Democratic candidate, Martha Coakley, the Attorney General, says she doesn't know how she'd vote. The leading Republican candidate, who also ran against you, Charlie Baker, says how he doesn't know how he's going to vote. How do they move ahead, the Gaming Commission, award licenses?
Yeah.
To a slot parlor and arguably as many as three casinos at the same and proceed at the same point that the whole thing could implode next November.
Well, so they have a job to do, and they have a legal requirement to do that job, and the people have an opportunity to pass on the question. It is in a broader sense an example of the hazard of trying to do public policy by popular referendum. At the time the gaming law was passed, it was very popular. It's not without its detractors. It's not without some misgivings I have about it. But
what are your misgivings?
Well, we've been talking about this for a long time. I mean, I think for me I'm past them. This is a historical note. But for me, the question was how to do this in a way that didn't undermine the character of the Commonwealth. You know, this is not central to our economic growth strategy. It's not, for most people, it's harmless entertainment. For some people, it is dangerous. It was important to me that we have a limited number of highly invested in, destination resorts, that they be spread out for that reason, that we not have a kind of a district that was all about gambling, that they have other elements around entertainment and meeting space and recreation and what have you, and that seems to be how it's shaping up. And also that we have some of the protections for people for whom gambling is a danger.
Okay, let's go to the calls. The number is 877-301-8970. Governor Patrick.
Okay, Lisa is calling from Newton. Lisa, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
How are
Governor?
You?
I'm okay, and I do have a policy question for you, Governor.
Sure.
As a disabled individual who's trying to stay in the community and live in the community, I want you to pay more attention to MassHealth and how inflexible it is, how hard it is to talk to policy people when you guys are doing stuff that's hurting the disabled. I know that I'm having a terrible time with MassHealth right now.
What's the trouble you're having, Lisa?
The trouble I'm having, Governor, is that I am on Medicare as well as MassHealth. And I also have Medicare insurance. My parents are elderly.
Yes.
I've been advocating for myself for a year,
mm-hmm.
and I had a taxi to take me to a longtime doctor. MassHealth pulled the taxi. I got a public interest attorney at one of the wonderful firms in Boston to help me with them pulling the taxi after 3 years. I just have found them, a taxi to my longtime doctor of over 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
When they have a choice not to pull it, I have found them acting in stupid ways, in destructive ways, in inflexible ways. I want to compare this to my mom's long-term care insurance policy, which I've had to help her deal with because she's very ill. Okay, so, you know, they have been so great and flexible. And I believe in government, by the way. Mm-hmm. I'm a big believer in government.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe that government should be at least as sensible as a private company and have ways to look at each individual as a separate individual,
mm-hmm.
and to talk to me when I'm making a good suggestion and not be, not work against me,
mm-hmm.
work for me. And I don't think this should just be for me. I think you guys are, it's a dysfunctional system. I've dealt with it for years. And
hey, Lisa, can we have the governor respond to some of this if
sure.
you don't mind?
Sure, I'm sorry.
No, apologies needed.
Don't apologize, yeah. And don't get mad at me because Jim interrupted you. I wasn't going to interrupt you, Lisa. I'm obviously
okay. So. You go ahead and respond.
Well, first of all, I apologize to you if your interactions with MassHealth have not been as smooth or customer friendly. And I know that the folks who are so-called dual eligibles, Lisa, who are eligible for both Medicare, which we don't manage, and Medicaid, which we do, have a whole host of challenges sort of sorting out which program covers what. The person at the other end of the phone I've heard some of these complaints before. I've also heard many compliments of the MassHealth team who deal with individual clients. The folks at the other end of the phone, in fairness to them, Lisa, this is not comfort to you, but in fairness to them, frequently don't have, in the case of government programs and MassHealth in particular, the flexibility that you and I wish they did, and frankly, they wish they did, to make different kinds of judgments. Now, that may or may not apply to your particular situation, as I was saying. But they're not looking for ways not to help people. They go to work and take these jobs in order to help people. And if you would like me to look into any of your particular issues, if you hang on the phone, I'll get your number, and I'll have someone in my office do so.
Hey, please stay.
I would like that. Yes, I would like that, Governor.
Okay.
Please stay on the line.
Hang on, Lisa.
One of our producers will get your number. Governor, on a semi-related note, the connector, Jean Yang, was before her board the other day and actually was talking about her staff and how some of them are embarrassed to go out in the world and say they work for the connector.
Yeah.
She breaks down crying, which I thought was a pretty powerful moment, actually. But stepping back from that a second, part of the – and you've spoken to this, but I'd like to get an update.
Mm-hmm.
50,000 applications apparently weren't entered. What's the state of affairs? Where are we in catching up and making sure that no one goes without?
So we're making progress. Let me first say that the objective, as you said at the end of your question, Jim, is that those who have insurance won't lose it, and those who need it will get it. And we're not going to let anybody slip through the cracks, and no one has slipped through the cracks. There's a tremendous amount of understandable anxiety because the tool we paid for that was going to help us transition to the ACA is not functioning well or well enough. I can tell you today, Sarah Islin, who is the project manager for The Fix, as you know, a really well-respected project manager, is doing a wonderful job, was at that board meeting, by the way, where Jean, I think, expressed just how deeply her own commitment has been and her team has been to this fix. Reported today, I think, publicly, that 22,000 of that backlog actually are insured, so they're okay, and that another 15,000 new applicants have been moved into coverage. So they're making progress, and that's since the course of the last week, and they're going to continue to make progress. By the way, there will continue to be applicants even with the extended deadline till the end of June. So the first thing I want to say, and what I think is important, is we've got a great project manager who is working on the fix and who is forward-looking. The second thing is that we've got the best IT consultant, frankly, the folks, the nationally recognized experts who fixed the federal website and fixed that of several other states, working alongside us to fix our own. And we've added hundreds of additional people to the call center to help work through individual issues.
What's your best guess of one, as to when they'll be totally caught up in terms of the backlog, and two, when they'll be functioning, as you say, forward-looking in a case-by-case appropriate basis?
So I think on the question of the of catching up, that's a straightforward question, but it doesn't lend itself to a simple answer because the deadline has moved, and because the deadline has moved, people continue to wait to file their for their ACA compliant policies. But they're making good progress, and they'll continue to do so. I think the bigger question for me, one of the big questions for me, is that this website, which is a tool and is meant to be convenient, whether there's anything in it that's salvageable, or whether we need to push the reset button. And Sarah Islin and Optum, the consultant, are working their way through that. They have consulted broadly. They've got some really smart technical people in trying to sort that, and I hope we'll have an answer to that really big central question very soon.
Let's go back to the phones, Governor Patrick.
Sure. Let's see. Judy is calling from Brookline. Judy, you there?
Hi, Judy.
Yes.
Hey.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
We have a luxury tax, or a tax on clothing that's over $175. I was wondering if we could raise revenue by lowering that to $100.
could we raise revenue by yes, we could. Is that likely to pass? I don't think so. I think the Judy, candidly, the interest in messing with the sales tax is probably pretty low in the legislature. My proposal, you remember last year, was to cut the sales tax to 4.5%, I think it was the proposal, and then to raise the income tax so that we would shift the burden to people who were in a better position to pay for it. And for about half the people in the Commonwealth, their total taxes would have gone down. But that did not win in the legislature, and there were many reasons. But one of them, I think, is that the legislature felt they had just touched the sales tax, and they didn't want to go back there again. But I hear you. I think it's I think the math works to your point, but politically, I don't think that one is on, at least not in this session.
Judy, thank you very much for the call.
Our number is 877-301-8970.
Marjorie, you're reading from the same sign.
I am. I should have it memorized by now, shouldn't I? I don't want to take any chances here, so I read it. 877-301-8970. Our email address is bpr@wgbh.org. And a couple of people have mentioned it was our fault. We didn't get you all the emails last month. We're going to do a better job today of getting all the emails to the governor's office. Go ahead, Governor, please.
Can I take
yes, absolutely.
Let's see. Alma is calling from Boston. Alma, you there?
Yes, I am.
How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thank
Good.
You for taking my call.
Sure.
And just a quick comment, totally unrelated to my question. Thank you so much for all you've done for the lesbian and gay population of the state. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I hopefully temporarily have a handicap access pass, and I've noticed a few times, like by my church and things, that there are either cars without a pass or maybe a delivery truck that might say, oh, I'm only going to be here 5 or 10 minutes, but in the meantime, there's no space for a car that needs a handicap access.
I gotcha. Yeah.
Is there a phone number or someplace we could call and say, okay, can we fix this?
Yeah, it's a great, you know, normally you would call the, you want to call the police, but you don't want to use an emergency number, the 911 number for that. There's probably a Boston park. This is in Boston, Alma?
Well, I've seen it in other areas, like once in a while around Somerville where I live, but I've noticed it on Boylston Street in front of the church much more often because it's such a busy area and there's a lot of delivery trucks.
Right. So I think that parking is regulated by the city or town. Uh-huh. If you want to hang on, we could probably chase down the Boston parking office, but I don't think there is one number statewide. But I'm not sure. If you hang on, let me check.
Alma, sure. Don't go away. Our producer is going to take your phone number. Thank you very much for calling. We appreciate it.
Great.
Governor Patrick, you're a very popular politician. A lot of the polls have you up at the top of the list.
Okay, here it comes.
Here it comes. Here it comes.
There's a but.
But there is a but, because you are getting kind of hammered lately by by the columnists in the Globe, Joan Vernacki, Scott Lehigh this morning. The Herald's been tough on you as well.
That's not new.
Well, we have been very tough on you in the past for a lot of we talked about the marijuana rollout and the DCF. My colleagues, Aaron Smith and Matt Stout, have done a great job reporting on DCF, the Children's Agency.
Yeah.
And I know, despite a lot of legislators thinking that Olga Roche should have to go, you have defended her and stood behind her. Yeah. But I guess one of the things that is hard to understand is DCF says things. For example, that a lot of the foster parents who have histories, criminal records, they're older convictions and that their aunts and uncles and grandparents, they did something in their 20s and now they're 50-year-old foster parents. But they don't supply the information. This is unique. Mm. Cops do it. Mm-hmm. Courts do it. They redact a lot of information. Mm-hmm. DCF doesn't. So I guess my question is, if she's going to stay, it looks like she's staying, how can people have confidence
that's a fair question. That's a fair question, and I have expressed my own frustration with the ability to defend the agency if they won't be more forthcoming with information. And I know the information, but much of it is protected by various laws and regulations around confidentiality. And I don't think – I think the agency believes that aggregating that information is not going to be convincing to the public. So we have sort of sent them back to say, look, let's have the lawyers take another look at the rules and see if we can't be more forthcoming with the data. Because I don't accept those comments, you know, when they're briefing me at face value. I'm asking questions, lots of questions, and looking for data. I think what's important to remember here at DCF are these points. Number one, the biggest issue at DCF, and we have known this for some while, is the level of staffing. It's enough social workers, and we worked out an agreement with the union a year ago. On staffing levels, because that has to be negotiated. We've asked the legislature to fund that agreement, and God bless them, they did. They haven't finished that work, but both chambers have voted on it. We just don't have the final bill yet. And we've assigned an HR person who is herself a social worker to start the recruiting right now. So as soon as the bill is in front of me and I sign it, we can start that hiring. The second biggest resource issue they have at DCF is technology, because there's a lot of information. I mean, these are families in crisis, right? That's why they're involved with DCF to begin with. None of these are easy cases. Every one of them has a lurking hazard of one kind or another, and most of the time they are triumphant at DCF, but sometimes they go really wrong. And the information that they need comes from many, many sources, schools, doctors, and what have you. And it's frequently stale by the time they get it. So real-time information and the technology to gather that and have access to it and to take pictures and so forth is something else we're working on. We expect to have some fixes in place within the next month or so there. And then the third thing is, you know, we have a the very best, and I made a point about this at the outset, I still believe is true. Evaluating DCF is not the job of amateurs. It is something we all care about. I'm heartsick about the stories I read. I'm a dad. You know, I get that.
Yeah.
So I don't. My first reaction is not as a politician, so-called. It's as a human being. And but getting sensible and experienced advice about whether the practices and policies we have at DCF are the ones we need is why the Child Welfare League of America is working with us right now, and they're being very thorough. They promised their final report later this spring, but to give us interim reports as we go along, and they've been briefing. They've been available to legislators as we've gone along too. So, I think those are the important things. I think you know, Olga Roche is somebody with 30 years of experience in child welfare.
Right.
She's been commissioner for 15 minutes. Basically, she hasn't been commissioner for very long. She's got a, you know, what we're trying to do is wrap some resources around her so she can focus on managing the agency and let other people focus on the outward part, you know, dealing with the incomings and the questions from legislators and the media. But I will tell you, as I have told her, if I thought it served the best interests of the children to ask for her resignation, I would ask for her resignation. But I don't think it does.
Has she offered it to you? Has she said to you, if you don't have confidence in me, Governor, I'll just step down?
Yeah, she's been very clear about that.
She has.
Oh, yeah. Everybody's been clear about that.
But just one last thing on this, because this is not a new problem for DCF. It's been a problem forever.
For decades, right.
With the whole confidentiality thing. I want to be clear. You're saying you're in favor of their finding ways to release more information.
Yes.
Because how it seems to me as a reporter, and that's what I am, that when DCF does something good, like in the Mattapan case where the DCF did try to step, that's the case where the 14-year-old child
allegedly shot his nine-year-old brother,
right. And the DCF was involved with that case, and they had tried to help his kid, the 14-year-old who had trouble.
They had him in custody.
And he ran away.
Yeah.
But it seems as though when it's something like that, the agency can say, you talked about it yourself, and the HHS guy talked about it himself. John Polanowicz.
Secretary of Health.
Secretary, I'm sorry. I was afraid I mispronounced his name. But John Polanowicz.
I think that's it.
Anyway, that John Polanowicz remarked on that when it's good for the agency, it's okay for state officials to talk about what the agency has done.
Right.
And you get suspicious that the reason we can't get this information is because they're covering up errors and mistakes.
I totally get where you're going. And by the way, we stepped outside the bounds of what DCF preferred by saying what we did about the Mattapan case.
Right.
All I'm saying is that and I'm not – by the way, I want to be absolutely clear. I'm not saying let's figure out a way to tell the good news and not to tell the bad news. I'm talking about let's figure out how to be more transparent about all of it. Now, understand these are not just personal judgments. There are laws here. And also understand if you're in that family – I mean we said things – let me make it more neutral.
The family where the child died.
If there were a family involved with DCF and a tragedy happened, explaining that to the public might be more information than other members of that family have.
Yep.
You understand?
I do.
So this is a very delicate situation. I realize that a lot of people view it and think about it from the perspective only of sort of media relations or crisis management, but there are human beings involved here in some very, very sensitive situations, and we're trying to find the right balance.
You know, you mentioned a minute ago, not as a politician, but as a human being. Just a couple of quick things as a human being. When you open the papers, and you have been pummeled, as Marjorie said of late, the Globe called you unruffled in a story they wrote about the criticism. How do you deal with people who are not anti-Deval Patrick, they're not ideologues who have been trashing you for 7 years, when they really strike hard at the core of it, what it's your management skills, your engagement, whatever. How do you take that personally?
Well, look, you know, nobody likes to read bad press, although I will tell you, I avoid most press about me, good or bad.
Do you not read
the bad
stuff
hurts your feelings and the good stuff goes to your head. So, I try to focus on the problems I have to solve. You know, there is I think, in any public management position, you're going to have to deal from time to time with mob mentality. Serious issues where people rally around a quick or simple fix, like the call for Commissioner Roche's resignation. Nobody's asked the second question, what exactly does that or would that solve? My job is to solve it. And I hear things like that. It makes me think of the simple thing. Do the simple thing, paper it over, and push it off for the next guy or gal, which, by the way, is exactly how we got the big dig. And I've said from the beginning, I'm not going to be that kind of leader. I'm not going to be that kind of leader, even in the last few months.
Fair enough. He's I was going to say he is Governor Deval Patrick, and that is obviously his voice by definition.
Did you forget who he was?
I didn't forget who he was. We're going to come back in a second, take more of your calls at 877-301-8970. So don't go away.
I just need to renew my driver's license.
Okay, so I'll need your license. Do we have the correct address and everything on there?
Who can convince more people to become organ donors? Organ recipients can be persuasive, but not as much as these people.
Did you want to be an organ donor?
DMV workers successfully signing people up. That's today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Baker Library Bloomberg Center at Harvard Business School, now exhibiting the art of American advertising with ads, trade cards, and catalogs from the dawn of modern advertising. Info at library.hbs.edu. And Downton Abbey from WGBH's Masterpiece. The season 4 finale finds the inhabitants of Downton facing an array of troubles. Watch the exciting conclusion of Downton Abbey, Sunday at 9 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Rush. She is Marjorie Egan. Governor Deval Patrick is with us. It's an odd time for him to be here at a 1 o'clock hour, but not in a bad way. He's here till 2 o'clock to take your calls.
I think we got bumped by a snowstorm or two, didn't we? In our
We may have. Actually, we did. It's 877-301-8970. Before we go back to the calls, just one other thing which you've taken some heat on: 20 licenses have been issued. I know they're.
Careful.
I know they're not final.
They're not even provisional.
Okay, whatever they. What are they? What's the adjective?
There was a cut from 100 to 20, but you're talking about medical marijuana.
Yeah, medical marijuana. So far,
talk
we have
about valid edition.
If I just can for a second, well, it did. Did you vote against that?
Look, this is not what I would have preferred for the Commonwealth.
Okay,
but heck,
the voters said they wanted it, which is the Constitution permits for that. Three of them go to Bill Delahunt, who I know, as I've disclosed every time I bring, I know quite well. I'm friendly with him. Your commissioner of public health, who says she was not involved in the selection process, disclosed at the end that she had thrown two fundraisers for him. We learn in Haverhill and on Beacon Hill that there were misrepresentations made by the people who received the preliminary approval. Marty Walsh is upset because an advisor to one in Roxbury is a former drug guy or something in California. This is not exactly a good rollout, is it, for the first stage of this? And so I guess where I'm going, should the whole process start over again?
Nah,
why not?
I don't think so. First of all, the process, so it's interesting. Sometimes I think no good deed goes unpunished. There is a lot of interest in being very transparent about not just the regulations and the forecast of what the process would be, which has been described as nation-leading, but the process itself.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than wait till the end when all that vetting and screening had been done, they said, well, we're going to do the first cut from 100 down to 20, and we're going to tell everybody who made that cut and make their applications public, make their scoring public. There are 9 other steps that each of these 20 have to go through before they get a license. And if somebody lied on their application, they're not going to get a license.
Well, were you upset when you heard that the Commissioner of Public Health had not disclosed till the end that she had thrown fundraisers in the 05, 06 or something for Delahunt, who won three, whatever
he won? We have a nickname
won.
For him.
What's that?
He's the Pot DA.
Well, whatever. Governor laughed at that, let me be clear. Were you upset about that?
No. We've got an ethics rules and an ethics commission for a reason, and she followed all the rules and had nothing to do with the decision. I don't know what else we're supposed to do. We set up these frameworks. We say this is how it's supposed to work. You are not supposed to go anywhere near something you have an interest in or an appearance of an interest in. She doesn't, and then she still gets hammered. So I think, look, it's the public the questions that have been raised are completely understandable. I'm not mm-hmm. quibbling with that. The business with the person who said they cut and pasted their the letter from some
state
city council
rapper, city council, yeah, whatever it was. Yeah.
I mean, it's very, very, very troubling stuff. But those folks, those 20 are not the licensees. There are 9 other steps, which include checking those references to see whether they are bona fide, going through the detail of each of the applications to check the veracity of the information, and requiring once they've gone through that there is an attestation saying yes, in fact, we really meant it the first time, and many, many other states. So I think the public should relax. There is a lot of interest in a lot of money involved in this. In this industry, they're going to be sour grapes. They're going to be people dropping dimes, the unsuccessful one. I mean, you know, that's part of it. At the end of it, we're going to have licensees that we can all be confident in.
Last thing before we go back to the calls, you have confronted, I think your critics would say, you've answered questions, and you have here about the criticism, whether it's DCF or the marijuana dispensaries and the connector. You're not running for re-election, as I think you know. If you were running for re-election, do you think you'd be re-elected?
Oh gosh, who knows?
What do you think? I mean,
you
what
know,
do you
I've,
think in your heart?
I've only done this 2 times.
I understand.
And
that.
In neither case have I taken a single vote for granted, and I wouldn't in the if I were running for re-election. I think I owe that, and I think any candidate owes that to the people you're asking to vote for you.
Let's go back to the phones, to Governor Deval Patrick.
Let's see. Mike is calling from Randolph. Mike, you there?
Hi, Mike.
I am.
Hi.
I am here. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
The reason I'm calling is I wanted to express a program that is a very successful program for convicts and ex-convicts and people that are involved with the courts.
Mm-hmm.
And the name of this program, Governor, is Delancey Street.
Delancey Street?
Delancey Street.
Yeah.
I would like Jim and Audrey, all your listeners, to Google DelanceyStreetFoundation.org. And
tell us about it, Mike.
Okay, this program is a mentoring program.
Uh-huh.
I had the opportunity to tour this program in 1993. The founder of the program is Mimi Silbert. She's actually a Newton native.
Okay.
And she started this program in 1972.
Is this a program here in Massachusetts now?
There is no. This program isn't in Massachusetts.
Okay.
Oh, too bad.
No, I know. Too bad. But it's no money to the taxpayers, Governor.
Mm-hmm.
No money. Marty Walsh and I have been running this by Marty. As a matter of fact, I just drew up a proposal for this program. But to get back to the program, it's a mentoring program, no staff. It's no cost to the taxpayers. Everything is done by donations. It has 2 major businesses. One is a 5-star restaurant right underneath the San Francisco Bridge.
Hmm.
And the other one is a moving company that generates over $3 million a year in the San Francisco area.
Mm-hmm.
And who's on board with this program is the governor, the mayor, Department of Corrections, the Parole Board, and it's a very successful program.
Hmm.
And I wanted to sit down and speak with you about it years ago. My brother-in-law was the dean of the house, Dave Flynn, who you know.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, and, you know, my sister Barbara. And
how about your cousins, Mike?
I got politics has been in my family all my life.
Okay.
We can tell.
Mayor Menino was actually my uncle's secretary back in the day.
Wow.
Yeah.
So Mike, I'm sorry.
No, you go right ahead, Governor, of course.
What I was going to say, Mike, is on the DelanceyStreet.org, that's the website you want
DelanceyStreet
me to check out?
DelanceyStreetFoundation.org.
DelanceyStreetFoundation.org.
Yeah.
Why don't you hang on, Mike? Just yesterday, and we'll get your number and connect you maybe with the commissioner over at DOC. Just yesterday, well, we were talking.
Let me just finish what I wanted to say.
I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Now, I'm a former prisoner,
mm-hmm.
and I'm 65 years old,
mm-hmm.
and if there's anything I know, it's the Department of Correction and the state and the commissioner and parole board people.
Mm-hmm.
The problem we have with the criminal justice part of it. With those people is that governors, as a rule, never get involved with commissioners and the courts as far as what you're talking about, reform.
Mm-hmm.
And I commend you for doing that. I work with Mel King also.
Good man.
Very good man from...
Hey, Mike, we love you, but the governor was mid-sentence, and let the governor finish if we can. We are going to take your phone number. Don't go away. And apparently...
All I was going to say is that it might be because we are right in the midst of rethinking the whole reentry system and making it more successful in the interest of public safety, maybe Mike could sit down with the commissioner or someone on the secretary's staff and flesh out a little bit more this idea of the Delancey Street Foundation.
Great. That's quite an offer.
Is that
Mike,
fair,
stay
Mike?
On hold. Is that good? Mike, stay on hold. You'll get the number. It'll be passed on to the governor before he leaves the building. Governor, back to the phones.
Great. Let's see. Ben is calling from Boston. Ben, you there?
Hi, Ben.
I am. Thanks, Governor.
How you doing?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right.
So I have a question for you regarding Andrew Cuomo's plan in New York to have community colleges run programs in the prisons over there. And I was wondering if there was anything like that being proposed. I know that just last month you introduced that partnership with ROCA.
Which is huge. Yeah. ROCA.
Yeah.
You know that organization, by the way?
I've read a couple articles about it, but that's about it.
Yeah. Really exciting. Intervention in the lives of high risk kids. Education is one of the big issues for prisoners, both as an explanation in part for why they end up where they end up, and as an element of successful reentry. The active participation of community colleges, to your specific question, in the programming that we do. I know it's happening out in Hamden County, as I mentioned earlier, under Sheriff Ash. I don't think it has been regularized elsewhere, and it's a great idea.
Ben, thank you for the call. We much appreciate it.
You know, Governor, we have a John O'Brien, former head of the probation department, facing federal charges for rigging the hiring in the probation department. Every day we open the paper, there's another politician who sponsored someone for a job, which is different, obviously, than rigging the hiring. But you can see where we have Scott Harshbarger today. We had Scott Brown before, Martha Coakley, DA, former DA Keating, now the Congressman Keating. This long list of and legislators that have sponsored people.
You're not going to tell me I'm on that list, right?
Not that I know of, Governor. You can announce it if you are.
I don't think so.
Okay. But I guess you wonder if this case does get to a jury, the public is going to look at this and say, okay, John O'Brien was the leader of the pack here. But it seems like every politician in the Commonwealth was sponsoring people. What do you think? Do you think it's wrong to sponsor people for jobs or it's patronage? But Patronage has been history going on forever.
I think it's wrong to sponsor unqualified people for jobs or to expect a quid pro quo for it. I don't know all the puts and takes of this case. I think I have been interested in the probation department being a part of the executive branch and working with the parole department because they do similar kinds of things with the same or similar populations and to the point of a smoother correctional system where you start preparing people for their exit from confinement the day they enter confinement. We could use a more natural and complete partnership with the probation department than we have. But, do I think it's a sin to refer somebody for a job? No, I don't. But I do think and people refer people to me all the time. But I think it's got to be somebody who's qualified in an ideal world. And I hope most of the time we try to do ideal stuff in our administration. You have to compete for it.
Governor, before we go back to the Coles, if the Speaker and Senate President, I know you meet with them quite regularly, mm-hmm. come to you and say, okay, there are X number of months left in your term. What are the two or we can't do everything.
Yeah.
What are the two or three priorities that matter most to Deval Patrick that need legislative action? What do you say to them?
So school funding is critical, and that's an element of the budget. I think that the legislature will support school funding, both the Chapter 70 funding, the K-12 mm-hmm. Funding, some additional funding for early education, and the enhanced support at the higher ed level, particularly if it is if the condition of that as it has been in the as it was last year was freezing tuition and fees. For another academic year. So that's one. There is some interest right now in updating our voting laws and registration laws, making it simpler for people to vote, same-day registration, mm-hmm. Even mail-in registration, things that have are not, wild new ideas but have been tried successfully in other states. I'd love to see that move. I'd love to see action on the minimum wage. Before the Senate, you're talking about legislative stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, right?
Where you need. Yeah.
I'd love to see action on the minimum wage before this session finishes. And I have supported the idea of comprehensive unemployment insurance reform alongside that. The Senate has taken some really promising steps. The House hasn't yet, but I think they're going to come back to it soon after they return. Those are a couple.
Fair enough. Let's go back to the calls. He's Governor Deval Patrick.
Let's see. Is it Tasia or Tasha?
Tasia.
Hi, Tasia.
Tasia. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm okay. Thank you.
Good.
I'm calling because I've just relocated back to Boston from Atlanta.
Welcome home.
Thank you. The weather's not very welcoming, though.
I know. You should have come in April.
I know. But the reason for my call is that I have a very young son, and he's my first son, and I'm very interested in him being very culturally involved.
Mm.
I know that there's a lot of programs in Boston where children can go to the science museum and art museums with a discounted rate. But when it comes to things like the Blue Man's Group and circuses and experiencing all the different circuses that come, it's very hard for us to go because we are a very low income. I'm a full-time student at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering, is there any programs or agencies that can help a low-income parent like myself keep my son involved and his mind active with these new events that come into town?
Tasia, you're a good mommy. Good for
you.
Good for you. I know of at least one initiative that I think DCF does every year for kids involved with DCF, with Big Apple Circus. I don't know whether it goes beyond DCF, but if you hang on, I'll find out about it. You are right that the Science Museum and the MFA, I think I'm right in saying this, the African American History Museum.
Yes.
And maybe even the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum have programs for kids and have a particular focus on low-income kids. I think I'm right about that. I don't know what's happening with the theater groups, but I'll bet somebody over at Emerson would know because they're really plugged in. Hang on, and
Look away.
See if we can connect you with some folks who who can help.
Tasia, stay on hold. You'll get a response. Governor, quickly, I interviewed a woman last night, Susan Sear, whose 32-year-old son died of a heroin overdose in Taunton. Yeah. You've seen the numbers. Yeah, just since January, 60-some overdoses, five. If you can, what's the state? Well, two questions. One, what's the statewide agenda on this? Mm-hmm. And two, I just learned, and I'm sure you didn't and most of our listeners didn't just learn about this Narcan, this thing the Boston police are going to embrace, which has this colossal record of reversing overdoses in Quincy.
Right.
Some like 211 out of 220 were essentially brought back from the dead.
Yeah.
So I guess two things. One, is that something that could happen statewide? And two, what else is going on to deal with what really is an epidemic?
I know a little bit about Narcan and the I've read the stats you have, and it's very, very promising. Obviously, it's a crisis intervention or an emergency intervention, I guess I would put it. We have another crisis about use and the accessibility of this really cheap, very potent heroin. There's another, in terms of treatment and recovery facilities, I mentioned earlier in the program with respect to prisoners in particular, our interest in expanding the – I shouldn't say prisoners, but those who are eligible for civil commitment, our interest in, through the budget, expanding the number of treatment facilities, the number of available beds. So that if a bed is not – well, so that we have enough beds available and we're not diverting people into prison. By the way, I think the drug courts – this is a footnote but is an important one. The drug courts are a terrific idea because they divert people away from the criminal justice system and into ways to basically get the habit that caused the problem fixed. And then we're going to start using Vivitrol, which you may know about is manufactured here in Massachusetts, an opiate appetite suppressant, basically, and you can treat heroin addiction as you would, diabetes, with a regular monthly injection, and you don't have the craving anymore, and helps people get better.
Governor, we want to do a shout out here. Our sister station WCRB 99.5 is airing this Wednesday at 9. Your narration of something called Napoleon to Dr. King. Where are the heroes? What's that about?
Really, they are?
Yes.
Wednesday, 9 o'clock. You're doing a commercial on my time.
We are. We're promoting this event.
So I got a call from a friend of mine, a college classmate of mine who is a conductor, who said that a colleague of his over at the New England Conservatory was producing, as a part of Black History Month, a series of concerts, one part of which was Dr. King's writing and speeches set to music. Now, I don't sing. It's just narration.
You do sing. I've heard you sing.
No, but I don't sing in this piece.
Oh. Okay.
Thank heavens. But there are this beautiful music, and then there are intermittent pauses where the narrator speaks, and I had a chance to do that. We had it scheduled for a night of a snowstorm.
Oh.
And it was, and it ended up being postponed, but we were able to reschedule. It was fun.
Wednesday night, 9 o'clock, 99.5. Governor, we only have a minute, so we'll try to squeeze in one more. And by the way, those calls we don't get to, we'll take your phone number. They'll go to the governor's office. But quick question and a quick answer if we can. Governor, do you want to pull one more phone call?
Sure.
Yes, sure.
Ann is calling from Hopkinton. Ann, you there?
Hi there.
Yes, I'm here. Thank you very much for taking my call, Governor.
Sure.
We literally have a minute, Ann.
Just a minute. My question is about the executive order you issued yesterday regarding banning shackling pregnant prisoners.
Yes.
Is that now the law in Massachusetts, or does it still have to get passed by the legislature?
No.
Thank you.
Yeah, great question. So it is. We've already banned it in the prisons, and based on emergency regulations issued yesterday, it is banned in. Houses of correction as well. So that's over.
Yeah, they were doing it in labor and delivery, apparently, in some of these situations.
That's the issue. I think that's what Ann was asking about.
Yeah, give birth, and they were giving birth handcuffed. Can you imagine?
Right.
I guess you can't, actually.
No, I guess that is. Governor.
My wife would have broken through those shackles. It's no doubt.
Exactly. Okay. You're also doing something real quick. It involves your dad. You're going to this.
Well, you did.
Last night.
It was last night.
That was amazing.
Yeah. Your father was a baritone.
He was a baritone
saxophone player.
For Sun Ra for the Sun Ra Orchestra. He was a founding member, and they had a concert celebrating Sun Ra's 100th anniversary, and three of the original band members were there. And one of them who just jammed on the saxophone is nearly 90 years old.
Did you speak to them?
I did.
Did they know your dad?
Oh yeah, they knew. They knew us. They knew me as my grandmother would say. They knew us before my sister was there. They knew my sister and me before we knew ourselves.
That's a pretty good line, Governor Patrick. Thank you. And by the way, you're on the home phone again, don't hang up. We take the numbers. If you email, we promise we screwed up last month. Not
we
the
did.
Governor.
We did. It was our fault.
We will forward everything to the governor's office. We promise, Governor. Thank you.
Thank you. You guys be well.
Patrick joins us every month. Next month it'll be after a spectacular performance of the St. Patrick's Day Breakfast. We hope. Thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in Monday, our political roundup with the Boston Globe's Joan Vinaki and WGBH's Peter Kazis. We'll also talk about a new Frontline documentary on the Vatican. We're running out of time, so I'm going to say real quickly, I am Marjorie Egan.
And I'll say real quickly, I'm Jim Browder.
Thanks for listening.